as it knocked the knife free of Saras's grip and sent the weapon flying into the log wall. Tornok sat with his arm extended, holding the tines of the fork against the underside of Saras's chin, tickling him with the points. The sharp-toothed man swallowed. A sheen of sweat had broken out on his face. Essie still didn't dare move. Saras's hand was next to her neck, fingers spread wide as if to tear out her throat. "Then again," said Tornok, "there's nothing in your charm to stop me from using magic on something else. Like this fork, for example." A feral gleam appeared in his eyes as he pressed the tines deeper into Saras's flesh. "Do you really think I need a sword to defeat you, you tumorous sack of filth?" Saras hissed. Then he shoved Essie into Tornak's lap and sprang backward, knocking his chair over. Essie fell to the floor. Terrified, she scrambled on hands and feet between the tables until she reached Mama's side. Around her, the common room erupted into a commotion, with shouts and crashes and breaking mugs. Her mother didn't say anything, just pulled Essie behind her skirts and grabbed a chair, which she held out in front of them like a weapon or a shield. The room had become a sea of thrashing bodies as the guests struggled to escape. The six fur-clad men had drawn their blades and were attempting to box in Tornak by the fireplace, but Tornak was having none of that. He had thrown off his cloak and was moving about the room like a prowling cat. Saras had retreated to a corner and was shouting, "Slice him crosswise! Kill him! Cut open his belly and spill his guts!" The nearest swordsman charged Tornak, swinging his blade. Tornak knocked the blow aside with his fork, and then he darted forward and buried the fork in the man's chest. Essie had seen plenty of end-of-harvest brawls, but this was nothing like a drunken fight between laborers. It was far worse. Sober men trying to kill each other in open combat, and it frightened her many times more because of it. She looked for her father and spotted him crawling toward the cover of the bar, blood dripping from a cut on his temple. "Papa!" she cried, but he didn't hear. Three more of Saras's men attacked Tornak. All three jabbed and slashed with their swords, not waiting for the others to take their turn. Tornak grabbed a chair and one-handed smashed it over the man to his left. At the same time, he used the fork to parry the attacks from the other two brutes. He matched each of their blows, fencing with amazing skill as they tried to get past his guard. The men had the advantage of reach with their swords, but Tornak sidestepped their blades and slipped into striking range. His hand was a blur as he stabbed with the fork. One, two, three, four hard impacts that dropped the men to the floor where they lay groaning. Across the room, Papa reached the bar and pulled himself to his feet. He still held the truncheon in his hand, but the leather-wrapped stick seemed useless compared to the flashing swords. "Essie," said Mama, her voice tight, "Ulfa's in the kitchen. I want you to go." Before she could finish, one of Saras's guards ran up to them. In his offhand, he held a mace, which he swung at the chair Mama was holding. The impact knocked the chair out of Mama's hands, breaking it. Essie had never felt so small or helpless as she did in that moment. Papa was too far away to help, and there was nothing Mama could do to stop the fur-clad man as he drew back the sword in his other hand. Thud. The man's eyes rolled until they showed white, and then he collapsed. And Essie saw the fork sticking out from the back of his head. Tornak had thrown it from across the common room. Saras and his last remaining companion attempted to flank the now weaponless Tornak. Before they could get close, Tornak kicked a table into the swordsman's stomach, and when he stumbled, jumped on him and knocked his head against the floor. Saras cursed and fled toward the door. As he turned, he threw a handful of glittering crystals at Tornak. Again, Tornak spoke a word, and at his command the crystals swerved in mid-air and flew into the flames of the fire. A series of loud pops sounded, and a fountain of embers sprayed the stone hearth. Before Saras could reach the door, Tornak caught up with him. He grabbed the back of Saros's jerkin and, in a stunning display of strength, lifted Saros off the floor and over his head, and then slammed him back down onto the wooden boards. Saros let out a bellow of pain and clutched at his left elbow, which was bent at an unnatural angle.
"Essie," said Mama, "stay behind me."
Essie had no intention of doing otherwise. The few remaining guests edged away from Tornak as he planted a foot on Saros's chest.
"Now then, you bastard," he growled. "Where did you find that stone?"
Papa left the bar and staggered across the room to where Mama and Essie stood. They didn't say anything, but Mama put an arm around Papa, and he did the same to her. A burbling laugh escaped Saros. There was a wild note to his voice that reminded Essie of Werick, the madman who lived under the bridge by the mill. Saros licked his sharpened teeth and said,
"You do not know what you seek, wanderer. You're moon-addled and nose-blind. The sleeper stirs, and you and me, we're all ants waiting to be crushed." "The stone," said Tornak between clenched teeth. "Where?"
Saros's voice grew even higher, a mad shriek that pierced the night air.
"You don't understand. The dreamers. They get inside your head and they twist your thoughts. Ah, they twist them all out of joint."
He started to thrash, drumming his heels against the floor. Yellow foam bubbled at the corners of his mouth.
"They'll come for you, wanderer, and then you'll see. They'll..."
His voice trailed off into a hoarse croak. And then, with one final jerk, he fell still. For a moment, no one in the common room stirred. All eyes remained on Tornak as he yanked the amulet off Saros's neck, retrieved his cloak, and walked back to the table by the fire. He pocketed the stone with the inner shine, picked up his pouch of coins, and then paused, considering. Bouncing the pouch in his hand, he came over to where Papa and Mama stood shielding Essie.
"Please," said Papa.
Essie had never heard him sound so desperate, and it gave her a sickening ache in her stomach. More than anything, his fear made her realize that the world was far scarier than she had originally thought. Their home had always felt like a safe place to Essie, but no longer. Neither her father nor her mother could protect her, not in the face of swords, and certainly not against magic. "My apologies for the trouble," said Tornak. He stank of sweat, and the front of his linen shirt was splattered with blood. Nevertheless, he seemed calm again. "Here, this should make up for the mess." He held out the pouch, and after a moment's hesitation, Papa accepted it. Papa licked his lips. "The watch will be here any minute. If you leave out the back, you can make it to the gate before they see you." Tornak nodded. Then he knelt and yanked the fork out of the head of the ruffian lying on the nearby boards. Essie shrank back as Tornak looked straight at her. "Sometimes," he said, "you have to stand and fight. Sometimes running away isn't an option. Now do you understand?"
"Yes,"
Essie whispered. Tornak shifted his attention to her parents. "One last question. Do you need the patronage of the Masons Guild to keep this inn open?" Confusion furrowed Papa's brow. "No, not if it came to such. Why?" "That's what I thought," said Tornak. Then he presented Essie with the fork. It looked perfectly clean, without so much as a drop of blood on it. "I'm giving this to you. It has a spell on it to keep it from breaking. If Yordas bothers you again, give her a good poke and she'll leave you alone." "Essie," Mama said in a low, warning voice. But Essie had already made her decision. Tornak was right. Running away wasn't always an option. That wasn't her only reason either. While their home might be safer than elsewhere, she couldn't count on her parents to ward off danger. The fight in the common room had proven that. Her only real choice was to learn how to defend herself and her family. She took the fork.
Thank you,
she said, solemn. All good weapons deserve a name, said Tornak, especially magical ones. What would you call this one? Essie thought for a second and then said,
Mr. Stabby?
A broad smile spread across Tornak's face, and all hints of shadow vanished from his expression. He laughed, a loud, hearty laugh.
Mr. Stabby, I like it. Very apt. May Mr. Stabby always bring you good fortune.
And Essie smiled as well. The world was big and scary, but now she had a magical weapon. Now she had Mr. Stabby. Maybe if she did poke Yordis, Karth would forgive her. Essie could just see the expression of outrage on Hjordis's face. Then Mama said,
Who are you, really?
Just another person looking for answers, said Tornak. Essie thought he was going to leave then, but instead he surprised her by putting a hand on her arm. He spoke words she didn't understand, and she felt them deep inside herself, as if he had plucked a string attached to her bones.
Leave her be, said Papa, and pulled her away.
But Tornak was already moving past them, his cloak spreading like a dark wing behind him. As his footsteps faded out the back, both Mama and Papa ran their hands over her head and arms, checking for injuries.
Are you hurt? Said Mama. What did he do to you? I'm okay, Essie said, although she wasn't sure at all.
A burning, tingling feeling swept through her left arm, and she cried out with pain. It felt like hundreds of ants were biting her. She tore at the cuff of her sleeve, pulled it back, and saw the top of her forearm crawling with a life of its own as the long, puckered scar smoothed over and began to fade into normal, healthy skin. The scar shrank and shrank until only a small, red S-shape was left. But it didn't vanish entirely. A remembrance of past pain. Of survival. Essie stared, hardly able to believe. She touched the new skin and then looked at her parents. This time, she made no effort to stop the tears that rolled down her cheeks.
Oh, Essie, Papa said, his voice thick with emotion.
And he and Mama folded her into a warm embrace. Outside the fulsome feast, Murtagh lifted his head and took a deep breath of the night air. Soft petals of snow fell around him, and the whole city felt still and quiet, muffled beneath a low layer of clouds. His heart was pounding. It had yet to slow after the fight in the tavern. Stupid. He should have realized that spending so much gold might cause a problem. It wasn't a mistake he would make again. How long had it been since he'd last killed a man? Over a year. A pair of bandits had jumped him as he was heading back to camp one evening. Foolish, uneducated louts who hadn't the slightest chance of taking him down. He'd fought back out of reflex, and by the time he knew what was happening, the two unfortunates were already lying on the ground. He still remembered the whimpers the one kid had made as he died. Murtagh grimaced. Some people went their whole lives without killing. He wondered what that was like. A drop of blood, not his own, trickled down the back of his hand. Disgusted, Murtagh scraped it off against the side of the building. The splinters bothered him less than the gore. Even though he hadn't gotten a location from Saras, at least he now knew that the place he was looking for existed. The knowledge left him feeling uneasy. he would have far preferred disappointment. Whatever truth lay hidden beneath the field of blackened earth, he doubted it would herald anything good or pleasant. Life was never so simple. And who were the dreamers Saros had mentioned? Always more mysteries. A questioning thought reached him from outside Siunon. Thorn worried for his safety. "I'm fine," Murtagh told him. "Just a bit of trouble."
"Do I need to come?"
"I don't think so, but stand by in any case."
"Always."
Thorn subsided with a sense of cautious watchfulness, but Murtagh felt the ever-present thread of connection that joined them. A comforting closeness that had become the one unchanging reality in their lives. He started through the alley. Time to go. It wouldn't be long before the city watch arrived to investigate the disturbance in the tavern, and he'd lingered long enough. A flicker of motion high above caught his attention. Murtagh stopped to look. At first, he wasn't sure what he was seeing. Sailing down from the underside of the firelit clouds was a small ship of grass, no more than a hand or two in length. The hull and sail were made of woven blades, and the mast and spars built from lengths of stem. No crew, if however diminutive, was to be seen. The ship moved of its own accord, driven and sustained by an invisible force. It circled him twice, and he saw a tiny pennant fluttering above the equally tiny crow's nest. Then the ship turned westward and vanished within the veil of descending snow, leaving behind no trace of its existence. Murtagh smiled. He couldn't help it. He didn't know who had made the ship or what it signified, but the fact that something so whimsical, so singular, could exist filled him with an unaccustomed sense of joy. He thought back to what he'd told the girl, Essie. Perhaps he should take his own advice. Perhaps it was time to stop running and return to old friends. The prospect filled Murtagh with a mess of conflicting emotions. Wherever he'd gone, he had heard the venom in people's voices when they spoke his name. No matter how vigorously Aragorn or Nasawada might defend him in public, few there were who would trust him after his actions in service to Galbatorix. It was a bitter, unfair truth, one that circumstances had long ago forced him to accept. Because of it, he had hidden his face, changed his name, and kept to the fringes of settled land, never walking where others might know him. And while the time alone had done both him and Thorn good, it was no way to live the rest of their lives. So again he wondered if perhaps the time had come to turn and face his past. But first, Murtagh looked down at the object he was holding, the bird skull amulet he'd taken off Saras's neck. What sort of enchantment had been placed on it that could withstand the name of names? Magic without words was a wild, dangerous thing, and rare was the spellcaster brave or foolish enough to tamper with it. He had not even dared use it himself in the fulsome feast, not with so many innocent bystanders nearby. No. Before anything else, Murtagh decided he would like to find the witchwoman Bashiel and ask her a few questions. The answers, he suspected, would be most interesting. Chapter 3. The Hall of Colors. It was night when Aragorn returned to himself, and the only illumination in the Hall of Colors came from the flameless lanterns on the walls and the inner radiance of the Eldonari themselves. He sat staring at the floor while he regrouped and recovered. A smile spread across his face. Murtagh. Aragorn hadn't heard anything from his half-brother since they'd parted outside of Urubane, now Illyria, after the death of Galbatorix. Rumours of a red dragon seen flying here or there throughout Alagasia had been the only clues that Murtagh was still alive. It was good to know he was doing well, or at least better than before. He deserves to be happy, Aragorn thought. Then he paused to consider the subject of Murtagh's search, as well as the witchwoman Bashel. Both concerned him, for they reminded Aragorn of how much he still didn't know about Alagaesia and its denizens. Ignorance wasn't a flaw he could afford any more. It could too easily prove fatal for those he and Saphira had sworn to protect. He hoped Murtagh would be careful. Wherever he was going, Aragorn felt sure it would be dangerous in the extreme. Murtagh was plenty capable, but he wasn't invulnerable. No one was. Again, Aragorn heard Murtagh's advice to Essie. Sometimes you have to stand and fight. Sometimes running away isn't an option. And Aragorn knew then why the dragons had shown him that particular vision. His smile returned, and he let out his breath. If a girl like Essie could stand her ground and face the difficulties of her life, so too could he, and with good grace. He was a dragon rider, after all. It was what he was supposed to do. Besides, none of the problems he was wrestling with were half so unpleasant or daunting as that nasty Hjordis. Aragorn chuckled and shook his head, glad he wasn't the one having to deal with the spoiled girl.
Did that help?
Glader asked. Aragorn nodded, although the dragon couldn't see, and stood, stretching his sore legs. Yes, it did. Thank you, Eberthil. All of you, thank you. A chorus of answering thoughts was his reply.
You are welcome, youngling.
One day, the dragons would no longer consider him an unseasoned whelp, but today was not that day. A wry expression on his face, Aragorn took his leave and climbed back up the ramp of stairs to the eyrie. Outside, cold stars shone down upon Mount Angor and the lands below. The sight reminded Aragorn of the grass ship Murtagh had seen, the same ship Arya had made one night by a fire, when she'd come to help him escape on foot from the Empire. That had also been the night when a group of wilding spirits had emerged from the dark and, during a visitation, transformed a lily into a flower of living gold. Arya had imbued the ship with a spell to draw energy from the plants beneath, so that it might always stay aloft and the grass would remain fresh and green forevermore. It gladdened Aragorn to know the ship was still out there, sailing around Alagaesia upon waves of wind. And he wondered at everything it had seen in its wanderings. Just another mystery among so many others. Saphira was waiting for him, curled in her nest. She opened an eye as Aragorn undressed and crawled under her near wing.
So?
She said. You were right, Aragorn said, settling against the warmth of her belly. I needed a break. A low humming formed in her chest.
You're much nicer when you're not snapping like an angry fox.
He chuckled. True. Then he shared with her the vision from the Eldonari. Afterward, she said,
I would like it if Murtagh and Thorn came to stay with us.
So would I.
Do you think we have another enemy hidden in Alagaesia?
I don't know. If we do, they're just one more added to the lot. I wouldn't worry about it.
No.
She took a deep breath and shuffled her wings as she readjusted her position.
No more worries for tonight. Leave them for the morning.
No more worries, Aragorn agreed with a smile. He closed his eyes and snuggled closer. And for the first time since they'd arrived at Mount Angor, he put aside his concerns and slept without anxiety or interruption. Part 2. The Witch. Chapter 4. Rhymes and Riddles. Aragorn stared across his desk at Angela the Herbalist, studying her.
She was sitting in the dark pinewood chair the elves had sung for him, still clad in her furs and travel cloak. Flakes of melted snow beaded the tips of the rabbit hair trim, bright and shiny by the light of the lanterns. On the floor next to the herbalist lay the weercat Solemnbum, in his feline form, licking himself dry. His tongue rasped loudly against his shaggy coat. Billows of snow swelled past the open windows of the eyrie, blocking the view. Some slipped in and dusted the sills, but for the most part, the wards Aragon had set kept out the snow and cold. The storm had settled on Mount Angor 2 days past, and it still showed no signs of letting up. Nor was it the first. Winter on the eastern plains had been far harsher than Aragon expected. Something to do with the effects of the Beor Mountains on the weather, he suspected. Angela and Solemnbum had arrived with the latest batch of traders, a group of bedraggled humans, travel-worn and half-frozen to death. Accompanying the herbalist had also been the dragon-marked child Elva. She who carried the curse of self-sacrifice Aragon had inadvertently laid upon her. A curse instead of a blessing, and every time he saw her, he still felt a sense of responsibility. They'd left the girl on the lower levels, eating with the dwarves. She'd grown since Aragon had last seen her, and now she looked to be nearly 10, which was at least 6 years in advance of her actual age.
"Now then, where's the clutch of bouncing baby dragons I was expecting?" said Angela.
She pulled off her mittens, and then folded her hands over her knee and matched his gaze.
"Or have they still not hatched?"
Aragon resisted the urge to grimace. "No. The main part of the hold is far from finished, as you've seen, and stores are tight. To quote Glader, the eggs have already waited for 100 years. They can wait one more winter."
"Hmm, he might be right. Be careful of waiting too long, though, Arjitlam. The future belongs to those who seize it." "What about Saphira, then?"
"What about her? Has she laid any eggs?" Aragon shifted, uncomfortable. The truth was, Saphira hadn't, not yet, but he didn't want to admit as much. The information felt too personal to share. "If you're so interested, you should ask her yourself." The herbalist cocked her head.
"Oh, touchy, are we? I suppose I will then."
"What brings you here, and in the middle of winter, no less?" She produced a small copper flask from under her cloak and took a sip before offering it to Aragon. He shook his head.
"Now, now, Kingslayer, you almost sound as if you're not happy to see us."
"You are always welcome at our hearth," said Aragon, choosing his words with care. The last thing he wanted to do was offend this quicksilver-like woman. "But you can't deny it's odd, venturing out across the plains in the dead months of the year. I'm just curious. You of all people should understand that."
"My, how far we've come from that day in Tirm," Angela murmured.
Then she raised her voice again.
"Two reasons. First, because I'm currently on a take-around with Elva. I thought it would do both her and me some good to leave the human parts of Alagasia for a time, especially seeing as how Nasawada's pet spellcasters in Duvrangurgata are making life difficult for harmless, innocent hedge witches such as myself."
"Harmless? Innocent?" Aragon raised an eyebrow.
"Well," said Angela, and her lips quirked with a smile, "perhaps not so harmless as all that. In any case, we've been to Duweldenvarden. We've been to the Dreamweld in Mani's caves, and we've stopped over in Trondheim. Felthindare seemed the next natural destination. Besides," she fiddled with the trim of her cloak, "it occurred to me that Elva might be able to help you soothe the minds of some of the Eldunari."
Aragon nodded, reading the meaning between her lines.
"That she might. And were I to venture a guess, I would say she might learn something by it also."
"Exactly," said Angela, with unexpected force. She wiped the water off the fur of her hood, not meeting his eyes.
"Exactly."
A deeper concern began to form in Aragorn. Of all the people and creatures he had met since discovering Saphira's egg in the spine so long ago, Elva was perhaps the most dangerous. His badly worded blessing had forced her to become something more than human, a living shield against the misfortune of others. As a result, Elva had gained the ability to foresee and thus forestall impending hurts. Nor was that the end to her powers. She could perceive the most painful thoughts in those around her, which was an intimidating, even frightening prospect. And for a young child to bear that burden, overwhelming. It never ceased to amaze Aragorn that despite his spell, Elva had retained her sanity. She was still young, though, and risks remained. "What are you not saying, Angela?" he said, narrowing his eyes and leaning forward. "Has something gone amiss with Elva?"
"Amiss?" The herbalist laughed, bright and merry. "No, nothing amiss. You have an overly suspicious mind, Shadeslayer."
He wasn't convinced. The rasping of Solombum's tongue continued unabated. Then the herbalist reached under her cloak and removed a thin, flat packet wrapped in oilskin.
"Second, my other reason for coming."
She handed Aragorn the packet.
"In light of my impending dotage, I decided to put pen to paper and write an account of my life, an autobiography of sorts, if you will."
"Your impending dotage, eh?" The curly-haired woman didn't look any older than her early 20s. Aragorn hefted the packet.
"And what am I supposed to do with this?" "Read it, of course," said Angela. "Why else would I traipse across the whole of Alagasia and beyond, but to get the informed opinion of a man raised as an illiterate farmer?"
Aragorn eyed her for a long moment. "Very funny." He unwrapped the packet to find a small collection of rune-covered pages, each written with a different color of ink. Shuffling through them, he saw several chapter titles. The numbers appended to them varied wildly.
"There are parts missing," he said.
The herbalist fluttered her hand as if the matter was of no consequence.
"That's because I'm writing them out of order. It's how my brain works."
"But how do you know that..." He squinted at a page. "This is supposed to be chapter 125 and not, say, 123.
"Because," said Angela, with a superior expression, "I have faith in the gods, and they reward my devotion."
"No, you don't," said Aragorn. He leaned forward, feeling as if he'd just gained the advantage in a sparring match. "You don't have faith in anyone but yourself." She made an expression of mock outrage.
"Here now, you dare question my conviction, Shortigal?"
"Not at all. I just question where it's directed. Even if I took your word at its face, what gods do you have faith in? Those of the dwarves, the Urgals, the wandering tribes?" Angela's smile broadened.
"Why, all of them, of course. My faith is not so narrow as to be restricted to a single set of deities."
"I imagine that would be quite contradictory."
"You're far too literal-minded for your own good, Bronson, as I told you before. Expand your conception of what is or isn't possible."
She eyed him with an aggravating amount of amusement.
"Perhaps you're right," he said, attempting to indulge her.
"Still, the gods didn't write these pages."
"No, I did. But now we're getting distracted by theology, and while it makes for delightful conversation, that's not my intent.
Are you familiar with the puzzle rings the dwarves make?" Aragorn nodded, remembering the one Oric had given him during their trip from Trondheim to the elven city of Ellesmere.
"Then you know how when they're disassembled, they look like a patternless bunch of twisted bands. But arrange them in the right sequence and hey-ho, there you go. A beautiful, solid ring."
Angela gestured toward the papers in his hand.
"Order or disorder, It depends on your perspective.
And what perspective is yours? He asked softly.
That of the ringmaker,
she answered in an equally soft tone.
Stop asking so many questions and read the manuscript.
She picked up her mittens and stood. We'll talk after. As the herbalist left the eyrie, Solemnbum stopped his licking, stared at Aragon with his slitted eyes, and said,
Beware of shadows that walk, human. There are strange forces at work in the world.
Then the weercat left as well, padding away on silent paws. Annoyed and a little disquieted, Aragon settled back in his chair and started to read from Angela's papers. The contrary part of him was tempted to read them out of sequence, just to spite her, but he behaved himself and started as he should, from the beginning.
Chapter 5 On the Nature of Stars. Preface. Many have deemed me a frivolous person, and that is just as I like it. When I was young, and yes, dear reader, I was once young, disregard the foolish words to the contrary from those followers of the doctrine of the residue, I made the error of showing myself to others, and in my youthful enthusiasm I repeated the mistake a grave many times. Do you wish to poke and pry, to see and know, to taste my soul? I am no capering child, no. No, I make mistakes rarely, and do not repeat them, for the mistakes of my profession come with a price measured in blood and flesh and lives. So, the tales contained in this volume are all true, and every one is false. I leave it to the discerning reader to untangle the contrary strands of history, memory, facts, and lies. I will say this, care has been taken to provide an accurate telling of the most well-known, and hence most misunderstood and ill-reported, events here recounted. The truth rarely lies in the middle, somewhere between two opposing viewpoints. In my experience, it is far more likely to be found a good deal above and to the left of the apparent, much proclaimed truths. Look up from the plane of human dealings, and you may see a dragon flying overhead, or at least an informative sky that warns you to take cover before the arrival of a storm. Many will advise you to dig for the truth, but you must never, never do that. I have dug, I have seen what lies below, and I would not wish that upon the worst of you. Strive for wisdom, or at least a decrease in idiocy. Angela of Many Names. Chapter 7 The Stars Move Across the Night Sky. When I was a child, this was an obvious truth. Something not even worth thinking about, like the rise of the sun or the change of the seasons. I vividly recall that night spent lying on my back in the high hill pasture, eyes wide open to the celestial show. The burning stars brought a cold glow across the whole clear sky, so far from the smoke of the town fires and the light of the searchers' torches. The stars trace their nightly paths over the land. They move. It is so obvious, how could it not be true? But the obvious is often an illusion. The seeding grass and late spring flowers were black silhouettes against the star-bright sky. The greenery was high enough to hide a heifer, thus giving the impression that I was peering up from the bottom of a hole. Even if the searchers came to this pasture, they could not have seen me from mere feet away. As hours passed, the stars turned above. Night chill drew the heat from my body, and I fell into a curious trance, not asleep. I did not dare close my eyes, but not fully awake. Thinking of it now, it is obvious what natural processes were affecting my body, but for many years they were mysterious to me. The world altered. In a moment I felt as if everything, the earth beneath my back, under my outstretched arms and palms pressed flat against the damp ground, became insubstantial. I was falling away from nothing and into nothing. My body had no weight and was both plummeting and floating, and yet was still pressed into the ground. My perception of time changed. The stars seemed to speed across the sky until I suddenly felt as if they were static and I was moving. The ground, the trees and mountains, everything was moving. I had no concept of planet then, but that was the right word, had I known it. Dawn brightened the sky, and still I had no perception of time passing. Then, with the first rays of sunlight, the trance broke, and I returned to myself with a shaken understanding of the world, and a new resolution to face the inevitable troubles, consequences, that were soon to strike. Chapter 23. The stars are stationary. The rotation of the planet creates the illusion of stellar motion. With the barest touch of a single finger, the globe silently spun on nearly frictionless dwarven bearings. It was a beautiful, glittering thing of near microscopic details incised into some unknown pale metal. Even the grandest geographical features of the world were reduced to tiny bumps and dips of cold metal under my fingertips. Doubtless my careless touch grazed over many a place I have since visited. I had felt a powerful fascination with the globe from the time I first set eyes on it. I had longed to study it for hours and days, to compare its features with familiar maps, and learn about the different methods of representing a round object on a flat surface. Though the globe was, I now know, a hopelessly incomplete depiction of our planet, it nevertheless was a captivating work of art, and I regret its destruction. A small price to pay, but still, art should be protected. But in that moment, the globe was a mere distraction that stole precious seconds. Time was limited. The library could shift at any moment, and the longer I lingered, the greater the probability that I would be stranded in some unknowable hinterland, some other space, neither here nor there. The inner door of the library only coincided with the outer door at particular moments, and I did not yet have the skill to perform the obscure computations required to predict the times of safe passage. It was an ingenious system for protecting the most precious of secrets. Regardless of the dangers, I was determined to take those first steps down the path to true knowledge. Overstaying the window of time that the library and the tower were connected was not my greatest fear, though. I was preoccupied by the possibility of being discovered in the library by him. The keeper of the tower had bought my apprenticeship with the promise of education, but the initial trickle of information had slowed to an occasional drip, just enough to wet my lips. And I needed to drink deep, to plunge and swim and drown. My disgust at that betrayal and desire for justice outweighed my dread of the consequences of being caught, but just barely. I needed to know. And stolen freedom is still freedom. Without the keeper present, doling out simple books full of concepts I had long since mastered, the library felt far larger than I remembered. The carvings on the towering shelves seemed to move ever so slightly at the edges of my vision, though never when directly observed. I searched swiftly, without further distraction, but with increasing desperation and lack of attention to my carefully prepared plan. I tipped back book after book, plain and gilded, narrower than a finger and wider than a hand, some improbably heavy for their sizes. Click! It was an unremarkable tome that triggered the hidden drawer in a nearby bookcase, along with the thrill that accompanies something unpredictable but much anticipated.
I lunged toward the drawer and in my haste toppled a flameless lantern from its stand. It did not break, it did not activate an alarm, but it did cost precious seconds as I struggled to write it with excitement clumsy fingers. My terror of leaving any evidence of my intrusion was poorly weighed against the danger of being trapped. Would there have been enough time without that error? Without the momentary contemplation of the globe? Or perhaps the venture was doomed from the start by my inexperience? All the gold in the world is worthless if you are wandering in an endless desert without a supply of water. What value do the secrets of the universe have if you are lost somewhere beyond the influence of known powers? The library shifted, and it felt like nothing and everything. The library looked exactly as before, but my entire body ached in resonance with the sudden wrongness in the underlying fabric of the universe. I was in the same place, and yet vastly elsewhere. I was trapped. Chapter 125. All matter in the universe is in motion. All motion is relative. It is time. It is always a time. I nodded. Elva invariably saw things in such a pleasantly askew way. After the heartbreak with Bilna, the idea of trying to teach another had long repulsed me. But more and more, I had been thinking of Elva's potential to be my apprentice, and obviously of what she could become without guidance. The walls, ceiling and floor of her chambers in the Citadel of Illyria were lavishly draped with fabrics, giving the impression of being within a tent, or perhaps the belly of some textile beast. She sat in a nest of pillows, comfortably threatening. She had grown sharper and longer since my last visit. "You know why I have come," I said. "Of course, you have heard of the latest intrigues." She imbued the word with poison. I sat opposite her, on the overlapping carpets that covered the entire floor of the chamber. "I heard that Nasawada no longer allows you to go into the city. Perhaps you are banned from parts of the Citadel. Perhaps your world is restricted to just these rooms." The girl eyed me with something akin to contempt. "No one can keep me imprisoned, you know that. I stay in my quarters because I prefer it. I can leave whenever I want. Theoretically. But then you would have the annoyance of constant pursuit. It wouldn't take much for a member of Duvrangar Gata to catch you unawares, while you are sleeping, for example, and bring you back." "Bah, you don't understand. Begone, and good riddance to you." She waved a hand at me and turned away. "I have heard stories, no doubt expanded in the telling, of your little outbursts, your demonstrations. I cannot blame Nasawada for trying to contain you. Trade negotiations set back by weeks, fights breaking out, the most important food supplier to the army found dishonoring the dwarven chapel. He was waiting for a friend. He had forgotten his clothes. It could happen to anyone." "Making the elven ambassador cry? In front of the Urgals?" Elva laughed. "That was fun." "You show them too much, and they will use it against you. I come here with an offer of help, if you want it." Elva just stared, a wise conversational technique that I recommend in a great many situations. I continued, "If I could take you from this place without anyone knowing, would you come?" Her chin lifted. "Why? So you can spy on me for Aragorn? So you can treat me like a dangerous animal that needs to be kept on a chain? So you can use me for some petty little plans? I've learned so much, so quickly.
People are fragile. Poke them here or there and watch them crumble. I don't need your help. Oh, you wish to be persuaded, is that it?
Again, an unblinking stare was her only response.
Very well. Aragon, removing the compulsion to help did not improve your life as you wished. You are stretching your wings, testing your abilities, and trying to find a place in the world. But with each expansion and experiment, you are reminded again that you will never fit in, and just be seen as you. Not a question, a statement, a needle to prick and provoke, an effective one.
Elva's face hardened, revealing only the tiniest spark of the raging flames behind her eyes.
Everyone wants things they can't have, don't they? Even you.
Oh, yes. I couldn't help but smile, though it doubtless incensed her further.
Elva, you know the game, but just the opening moves. I can show you so many things and keep you safe until such time as you choose to return to this life. The span and depth of existence is far greater than anyone can know, not even the oldest dragon or the wisest elf.
I have seen more than most, but even that is less than a particle of dust, smaller than the smallest thing, and then smaller still.
Elva bit her lip, for once looking like a normal child. Ah, there it was. The vastness of everything would not persuade her, but it did achieve the first step. Reinforce her perception of my mastery. So, time for her real desire. I have made myself immune to your ability so I can offer you a time of peace from all the suffering that constantly impinges on your mind. You can learn who you are and what you want to be. And when you return, you will have a new command over your life. Yes, there will be boundaries and restrictions while you are by my side, but I don't need the power derived from your curse, Elva. I have no need to break or bend you.
She gave me a look, such a look. Hope, when hope is not allowed. Hope poisoned by profound bitterness.
Easy words, she said. Am I lying?
You know I can't see when people are lying.
Yes. You must choose with incomplete information, just like everyone else.
Do you wish to come with me, Elva?
Think carefully. I will not return again with this offer.
Then it was my turn to stare and wait for a response. In any other child, Elva's deep scowl would presage a tantrum. But her control did not weaken.
Do you really think the guards would let you take me? Ha! In just the last fortnight, they've stopped 2 attempts to steal me away.
Anger made her usually cool, contemptuous tone waver. I made no attempt to hide my unease.
I hadn't heard.
Then your departure is all the more important.
I suspect that dangerous groups are determined to have you as a weapon.
Ha! I know. They have no understanding of your power, though they believe they do. And what people think they understand, they think they can control.
I'm not going to hide who and what I am.
There is great value in stealth. You have already attracted much attention.
Oh! I have guessed your plan. You will have me talk my way past the guards. But it won't work. They are warded against me. They're afraid of me.
And there was a deeply worrying touch of pride in Elva's voice. Neither the guards stationed outside nor the heavy wards on the room mean a thing if I want to take you from within these walls, I said.
Elva made a scornful noise.
Just tell me, do you wish to go?
What I wish has never mattered, not from the moment that Aragon spoke his words.
Do you wish to go?
What is your plan?
Invisibility? Addling the guards' brains? Tunneling through the floor? None of those things will work. No. I will simply open a door, and we will walk away. Nothing more.
Ha!
Proper disgust this time. I stood. For the last time, do you wish to go?
Yes. 1,000 curses on you for making me want things. Yes.
Then come. I held out my hand, but Elva did not accept it. Without assistance, she climbed out of her nest of pillows.
Fine, but I still think you are lying. They've planned for every possible way out of here.
But not, I thought, the impossible ways. There was so much work to do with Elva, yet I found myself oddly looking forward to it. She had great potential to understand the incomprehensible. Gather what you wish to bring, and we will go. Though she was clearly skeptical in the extreme, Elva put a small wooden cask and a miscellany of oddments on a blanket and tied it into a bundle. What of your caretaker, Greta? I asked.
I've seen to it. She will live in comfort the rest of her years.
That is good of you, but events are often unpredictable. You might never get the chance to see her again. Forestall future regrets by saying a proper farewell now. Elva hesitated, but in the end she did as I recommended. Not wanting to be seen, lest someone later rummage through Greta's memories, I slipped behind a fold of drapery while the girl rang a bell. Greta arrived quickly, ever attentive to the needs of her charge. She was understandably distressed by Elva's farewells. The old woman was utterly devoted to the girl and had sacrificed much to protect her. I admired the tenacity and determination with which Greta had pursued her purpose. When she spoke of her fears that Elva was far too young to go unprotected into the world, Elva assured her that she would be safe and thanked her for all she had done. But Greta would not be dismissed. She talked in circles, returning to the same points again and again, how she loved, was proud of, and wanted to protect Elva, as she struggled to express the depth of her feelings. Elva's responses grew snappish as her caretaker continued. Then she became quiet, and I was concerned. I was about to intercede, when Elva said something softly, and Greta shrieked a horrible, strangled sound, like some dying animal. Whatever fear Elva had given voice to, it struck her caretaker a near-mortal blow. But then the girl murmured again, and Greta exclaimed again, but in a very different tone.
"You monstrous thing! You can't break something and mend it a moment later with pretty words! Broken things stay broken. Wounds heal into scars, not skin. I love you. I love you so much. Do you even know what that means? I will love you and worry for you with every breath in my body so long as I live. But I will never again trust you."
After brief shuffling sounds, the door moaned closed. And then the room was terribly quiet. I stepped out from my hiding place. Was that really necessary? Elva shrugged, trying to appear unaffected by the consequences of her actions, but she was pale and shaking. Then she looked me in the eye, and in just a few words, spoke my deepest fear. Although I live every moment with the knowledge, hearing someone else say it, even without understanding the implication or meaning, felt like being stung by 1,000 wasps, countless stabs of fear and surprise and pain. I should have been safe from her power, but somehow the curse had circumvented my wards.
Again and again, the deep magic of the dragons tried to fulfill its purpose, finding ways around even the strongest protections. I resolved to redouble my wards as soon as possible, to forestall Elva's prying powers, at least for a time.